Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and it's time for a podcast. Today, we're going to be talking to boss girl Karen Hinton. And for those of you who don't know Karen, I'm going to give you a little intro. Karen is a Mississippi native. She's a nationally recognized media professional in Washington and New York, and she's worked with some of the most major people in politics, from being a press secretary to the former housing secretary Andrew Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and also working as with congressmen, working with President Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. And from all this experience, she's written a book, and she's going to teach us today about penis politics. With that, welcome, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to find out about your experiences. You've done so much as a woman and also at such an early age, and you've had a bit of a rocky road, and you've been so public about your experience to help other women. So tell me, what got you into politics? And then we're going to talk about what's penis politics.
Okay, great. Well, I got into politics because I had been a journalist. I had gone to Ole Miss and majored in journalism and political science. And I just was trying to decide, do I want to be a journalist or do I really want to be in the middle of things? And I decided at some point that politics was my calling. So I went to work for a man who ran for Congress. He became the first Black congressman from Mississippi since Reconstruction. And Mississippi has the highest Black percentage of any state. And so it was about time that someone was their voice in Washington, D.C. and spoke to their issues. And I was really passionate about the entire campaign and how we worked so hard to try to elect him, because I felt like growing up in Mississippi, which is one of the poorest states in the country, if not the poorest state in the country, so many problems with poverty, education, teenage pregnancy, a lot of things that people in low-income communities face, that they needed someone in Washington trying to help. And after he served as a member of Congress, he was nominated to be the agriculture secretary under Bill Clinton. And then Benny Thompson became the congressman from the same district. And I don't know if any of you know Benny Thompson, but he headed the committee that did the January 6th hearing in Congress. He became a very powerful member of Congress as well, even though he represents the poorest congressional district in the state. And he's fought very hard to try to change that. So that was the reason I got into politics, and I loved most of it, and some of it I didn't love so much.
That's right. So in 1995, you joined the Clinton administration, and you were press secretary for Cuomo at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. This is kind of right when President Clinton was facing all those charges of womanizing. And what was your experience with President Clinton? We might as well dive right into the juice.
Let's do that. Well, I first met Bill Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas, because I was involved in Mississippi politics, and the two states are right up against each other. And he supported Democratic candidates in Mississippi, and we supported him when he ran for governor. So our paths crossed. And I was very young then. I was about 24, I think, when I first met him. Mm-hmm. And we had this encounter with two people who he already knew and were close friends of mine. And we sat together at a table in a bar and talked about politics. And for some reason, he became completely attentive to anything and everything I was saying. And I felt a bit uncomfortable. I thought it was odd, because here I was young and I didn't know any famous politicians or even the governor of Mississippi, much less Arkansas. But he was listening to me and he kept asking me questions and I kept answering him. And pretty soon I felt like, oh gosh, you know, he really does think I know something about all the problems facing Mississippi. Then he started talking to the other two people who were with me. And then suddenly he wrote something on a napkin and passed it over to me on the table. And I opened the napkin, and it had the name of a hotel in Greenville, Mississippi, where I was, and a hotel room number, and then a question mark. And, you know, here's this 24-year-old young woman who really was shocked and didn't know what to think about that. And I just sort of sat there paralyzed, and I folded it up. I took it with me, and I went to the ladies' room. And I
good
just
for you.
Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I didn't look at it. No, I just kind of bowed my head, got up, and left. And then I left. And unfortunately, I threw away the napkin at some point. I should have kept it, but I didn't. but I was later, as I processed all that was that had happened that night, I realized, you know, he didn't really care what I thought about any of the issues that I had brought up on my own, even though he acted very interested. You know, he knew he was alone in Greenville, Mississippi for the night. And why not, right? Give it a go and see what happens, right? And
he's very, very charismatic. Like I remember I met him a couple times, and those deep piercing eyes, and he takes your elbow and just the way he talks, he's like mesmerizing. My God, you think you're the only one in the whole room.
And look, that made him a great politician in so many ways, because he did have that ability to really enter into another person's space. And for the most part, it was okay. But for a lot of times, it wasn't. And he did that in Arkansas. And it came up during the campaign when he was running. But he fought it. And I was surprised that he won, but he did. And then later on, we all know about Monica Lewinsky now, that happened later on in 1998, which was a real crying shame, because she was young. She was 21. Yeah. And right. And she didn't know how to handle her own feelings about, you know, being in the Oval Office with the President of the United States.
That's so scary.
it stayed with her entire life.
She's about to destroy her. It's a miracle that didn't destroy her fully. But I mean, she had her blue dress, and you had your napkin. And then as a result of kind of not engaging, were you kind of pushed to the side? Were you sort of like your importance in the campaigns was then minimized, or you were eased out of things?
Well, that happened when I was working for Andrew Cuomo, who a New Yorker who came to work for Clinton in the first administration and second administration. He was housing secretary for him in the second administration. And he was a very difficult personality to work for. But the one thing he wanted more than anything was to be in favor with the White House. So when Monica Lewinsky, when that story about her came out, and then later a book about her came out, you know, he was trying to protect the president in any way that he could, by giving the president's people advice about how to handle the negative press he was getting. And then, of course, he ended up impeached, right, as we may remember. But during that time, I also had to struggle with Cuomo's inability to deal with women appropriately in the workplace, which is another story I won't get into at this point. But I'm struggling with that. And I end up having serious disagreements with Cuomo about a number of issues that we're dealing with at the housing department. And I just, you know, I was just so upset about the whole thing. And in the meantime, a reporter, Michael Isikoff, who's the author of the book about mostly about Clinton, it's called Uncovering Clinton, and it's about his issues with women. And he wanted me to tell my story on the record to him in the book. Mm-hmm. And I had avoided it for several years because I didn't want anyone to know, because I was working in the administration and I didn't want to lose my job and I was afraid I would. But after working there for 4 years, and Monica Lewinsky is being called all kinds of terrible names by Clinton, by Clinton's people, you know, just a dumb blonde, trailer park trash. I mean, they had all these terrible things they were saying about her. And I just decided, yeah, okay, I'll go on the record. So I tell my story. He wrote about it. It appears in the book. The book comes out. And Andrew is not happy. Andrew Cuomo is not happy that I've done this, because I am now working for him. And the White House is saying, hey, you let one of your staff do this to the president. What's wrong here? And I later learned that he would not fire me because he knew by firing me, it would just generate another negative story. Mm-hmm. But he didn't give me the job that I wanted, which was a housing assistant secretary, which is a great thing to have on your resume if you're working and living in Washington, D.C. And I didn't get it. And I didn't get it because that was my way of being punished.
You're being
and pushed
held
aside.
Yeah.
As you said.
Kind of being minimized. So that's what inspired you to come up with this whole term of penis politics, which I think kind of has global weight for women in every field and every industry. Talk a little about that.
Absolutely. I think that is exactly right. It's not just about women in the movie industry or women in politics. It's about every woman in every profession, from, you know, working in a law firm to working in the grocery store. And it really interrupts, blocks, ruins, ends a career that you want to build as a woman, or you're just a single mom with kids and you need to find a job. You take a job at a grocery store and you can't speak out about your boss because he will say you're lying and you'll lose your job. And you can't lose your job. You need to keep it. So that's a huge struggle. And what happens, and the reason I, you know, came up with that word penis politics, is because it is not just about sex, but it's always about power, mm-hmm. control, and authority. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's sexual harassment. Sometimes it's sexual abuse, sexual misconduct, but it also is about discrimination. When a man blocks you from doing better in a job, or prevents your promotion because he doesn't like you, or you don't look good enough for him, or he thinks that, or you've turned him down for a date and then mm-hmm. shown no interest in him in a sexual way. So then he takes it out on you. And so, you know, one day I was sort of trying to figure out, what am I going to call my book? And I had used the term penis politics before with my husband when we talked about things that was happening in the news, whether it was about a local elected official or a New York official or the movie industry. And I would always say, oh, this is just penis politics. And then one day I said, no, that's going to be the name for my book. I also wanted to draw attention to the book. And I think some people probably find the book title shocking, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to shake things up and get mm-hmm. people to pay more attention to the issue, men and women, so that, you know, we can really deal with the misogyny and the discrimination and the abuse, which also can end up with violence and rape. And all those things are really issues we struggle with now, still today.
It's very challenging because I think in many ways, women haven't been given the tools We don't know how to negotiate with men on any other front than what we're taught is from childhood onwards, to be a Disney princess, to be beautiful and exotic and charming, or yes, gifted with magical skills. Like, you know, in the beginning of your career, when you're 20 or 30, like, you don't learn the confidence in your personality and your workability and your skill set. You learn that later. So in the beginning, it's all, we also put ourselves out there in a very, we want to beautify ourselves. We're somewhat sexualized. We wear sexy outfits. Like, and it's not a bad thing. It's what society has shown us as successful women dress like this, or, you know, women who want to get ahead look like that. But I think that we don't have the tool. We're not teaching our 20-year-olds the tools to go out there in the business world, in any industry, and be assertive, confident, not offend men, and to know how to deal with not just men, but, you know, anyone in a person, a position of power. Like, I really feel like we have to deal with that, because to some extent, we also, we meet them at their level. So we come to the playing field sometimes. You know, I try to dress professionally. I try to not look too seductive, but I also, I love to wear a little makeup. I love to look feminine. It's very hard to draw the line. Like,
it's okay. It's okay to be feminine, because you want to be. And if
you do,
I believe if you want to be, then you should be. I think we should have those opportunities and not be judged by them if it makes us feel good about ourselves. One day I could wear a workout uniform down the street, and the next day I'm going to wear maybe a dress, and maybe the neck is cut a little low, but that's just what I want to wear. And I think we have to move away from judging women and girls based on what they're wearing, because they have to come to their own conclusions about how they interact with people at school, in college, in the classroom, in sports. Just think about what's happening in the sports world with the coaches. Every day I see a sexual harassment story about a coach somewhere.
Yeah,
because they're in a position of power with a vulnerable child,
right,
or girl.
Exactly.
But it is a dilemma, because, like, okay, I've, after 10 years, got to be chairman of my department of surgery. And when I ran the department meetings, part of my brain intentionally chose to show up in a, you know, navy blue business suit, because I wanted the commanding authority, and I wanted to desexualize myself and remove any femininity so people would take me seriously, all the surgeons that I have to talk to. I didn't show up wearing a pink dress that day. So
right. There
is still that sort of convention, you know, and maybe that's the Hillary Clinton pantsuit concept. I don't know.
No, but, you know, also, if you're feeling like you should wear the navy blue suit, you know, with it buttoned to the top, that's okay, because that's what makes you feel comfortable. But if, you know, if one day you want to just show up in blazing red or high pink, then do it, right? Because you should not be judged by what you're wearing. And that's something that we need to, and I don't have all the answers to it, but we need to figure out how to handle that for especially young women and girls, because they really struggle with that now, what they should wear or shouldn't wear.
They really do. And I think it's true in every field. You know, there's a dark side to every field, in surgery and medicine and in aesthetics. Like, so often, like this, I talk about our industry, 90% of our clients are women in aesthetics and cosmetic surgery, right? 90% of our injectors are women. And then 10%, the men are running the boardroom industry, the marketing campaigns, the imagery that's put forward, right?
Right.
The salon, the med spas.
What? And what would they know about that exactly?
Exactly. So they're in a way legislating our beauty, and, you know,
they know there's money to be made there, and they want the money, so they take over, and they don't give women the opportunity to be part of the discussion about how do we market this product, what do we want to say, how do we want to help women.
Yeah, it's
Well, all
changing.
the
I
pressure.
mean, more and more it's changing, and the more we
That's
complain,
right.
the more we get lip service of so and so is appointed to be a VP, and that's okay. Now we have this many women in place, so it's going to change because any
Yes.
woman in a position to help make change is, I have confidence that they will, but it's sort of just a very slow process of breaking the Barbie stereotype that we've all been like, it's all been forced on us. And
Yes.
like a book like yours definitely draws great attention to these ideas. What advice would you give a woman who's in an awkward position? Like, they've been at a conference all day and they're going out with the team, and then the boss and the VP and marketing, everybody's sitting right there around a few drinks. They get a little loose and some inappropriate comment is said. What is the correct reaction? Of course, very individualized, but we got to give people talking points.
Right. I think it's very important to make clear that the remark or the action is not acceptable. And that even though we are in a more collegial setting than the workplace, it's not appropriate. And that needs to be communicated to the man or the woman who does it. And then you have to decide, as the person who feels, verbally abused or emotionally abused, then she has to think, okay, is this something that I want to take a step further and talk to my boss or the human resources person or just a colleague? Because, each step you take, you do open yourself up for criticism of yourself. And you have to be ready for that, and you have to be strong and prepared for it, because he could come back and say, no, she encouraged me to do that. She's the one who said this that made me think I should say what I said, right? And so, you have to be prepared. And I think the way to get there is parents and relatives have to start talking to boys and girls when they're young about this issue and learning how to show respect to both sexes and make that part of the conversation that you're having with your children. It's not just, don't touch that hot stove, but it's right, but it's also, you need to be nice to girls and boys in your classroom, and here's why that's important. You'll grow up and learn how to be respectful, and people will respect you in turn. So, I mean, I think that we have to do more of that. And as the kids get older, they'll start to see it. They'll start to see it play out, and it'll click with them. And I think that's why we have to get to a place where by the time a woman is, verbally attacked in a restaurant or a bar, then she will have the strength and courage to say, that was inappropriate. I don't appreciate it. Please stop.
I mean, just those three phrases are great. 'Cause like we teach our girls self-defense. I put my girls in classes before they went to college, and we should teach our boys that too. We have to teach what's an inappropriate touch, or if someone puts their hand on your back in a delicate manner that's too touchy-feely. Like we have to make sure we call it. And sometimes that's awkward when you're the person that has to say, "Hey, you're making me uncomfortable," but you have to be willing to be awkward. In surgery, I've had to approach that, like in the operating room, all the guys are around the operating table. You don't know when you're the patient, but we have conversations when you're asleep and we're operating, and the brain is talking, the hands are doing. But sometimes someone will say a fully inappropriate, either racist or sexist or pig-headed remark, or very seductive and propositiony kind of a thing. And then as a woman in surgery, you learn to joke, but needle them back in a way that they know it's not appropriate. So, I mean, there are techniques to do this, but I think you're absolutely right. The first step is, hey, you're making me a little uncomfortable. Seriously, seriously? You're asking me that in this day and age? Something to call them. You gotta call them when they say these things.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. And the more we do it, the more it happens. then more other women and men will start to do it as well. For example, male colleagues in the workplace, they should walk over to the man and say, "Hey, buddy, this is not good for either of us because, you know, this is going to create issues in the office. Somebody is going to complain about you. And then suddenly, you know, everybody's going to be looking for anything that we do is wrong." So,
and no one wants that. No one wants to create a workspace where everyone is walking on eggshells and there's HR issues every which way you turn. Nobody, you can't get any work done. And you have to give people grace and understanding that the average human is a good person, good character, and maybe has, you know, occasionally a bad thing slips out of their mouth. So give them a little grace. Right. But I think you're absolutely right. It's a challenging situation. How did you find the courage to speak out knowing that your whole career would be jeopardized probably? I mean, you've worked with a lot of big names. I know every name on this list.
Well, something happened to me that changed my life dramatically. And suddenly I became very interested in writing a book. In 2017, I fell off of a treadmill and basically banged my head on the floor of the gym where I worked out. And it was underneath a very thin carpet was concrete. So when I hit, it was pretty bad. And I had to, I went into a coma. And for 2 months, I didn't know. I don't remember those 2 months at all. I had to have it. Right. I had to have immediate surgery because my brain was swelling. So they had to take a piece of my skull out and let it rest in my tummy for a couple of months, take it back out of my tummy, put it back on. And as a result of all that, I basically had to learn how to walk, talk, write, and think again. And
wow, that's crazy.
And that was what I did. My whole life, you know, I wrote things. I spoke on behalf of politicians. I had to think up messaging for them. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I couldn't do any of those things anymore. So I had a long time at home trying to learn all of those basics again, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened to me was I stumbled over diaries that I had written in high school in my attic where I had stored a lot of things like everybody does. But I found it and I started reading it and I read some of it to my husband and he said, "You need to write this down. This will help you in your recovery." Mm-hmm. So write it down and see how it sounds, and that's another step you can take. So I did, and one thing led to another, and 3 years later I finally written the book called Penis Politics. And just through the high school stories, I found a lot of similarities between what I went through as a 16, 17, 18 year old and till I'm now, you know, in my 60s. So I realized how there was a path that I had taken and why I had taken the paths I had based on what happened in high school. And just quickly, I'll tell, or maybe I shouldn't tell because maybe people will want to buy the book just to hear the story about high school.
Your new project, yes.
All right. But a very close friend of mine, she is raped by a school official in the book room. And she comes and tells me and two other friends of ours, girlfriends. And it really changes our whole high school experience because she won't let us tell anybody. And she won't tell anybody because she's afraid that he will say she's lying. She's making it up. And that is so common in most sexual abuse and rape is the man saying, "What? I didn't do that. She's making that up." And that happened to her. That was in 1974. And so forever it's gone on and continues today. But what happened to her and then to us as her best friends made changes in our life as well. And I think that's why we really need to take this problem seriously and keep talking about it.
Well, I love your ideas of teaching more at a younger age and the idea of equipping 20-year-olds as they get out into the universe of the work world, you know, the language skills and the confidence skills and the how to draw the line in the sand, because everyone needs that. Male, female, it doesn't really matter these days. There's so much gender fluidity, like you can be harassed and, you know, bothered by a person of any sex. So I think it's important that we teach that inclusivity training, and it's all about defining your boundaries, right? What works for you and what doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, definitely. And women just want to be respected in the workplace. That can't be so hard to do. And we have to just keep pushing for it and never let go of it. And I hope one day that we won't be talking about this anymore.
I love that. And I'm so proud of you for what you did. And you're a role model for all of us to ask for a place at the table. You know, it's enough to you want to ask for change. You want society to change. But in order for change to occur, you have to raise your hand, show your voice, share your pain points, and ask for a seat at the table. And that's so important, because otherwise you won't get that.
Yes. And it's tough. It's tough when you leave high school or when you leave college. You're so afraid of the real world. You know, what am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do? It's complicated.
You just want to blend and not stick out. But we're going to raise the next generation to stick out, stand up and stick out.
Stand up, stick out, don't shut up. All that's right on.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. I had such a great time chatting with you today. Where can people find you on your Instagram handle?
Well, you can find me on my website. The best way to find me, it's www.penis/politics.com. You can email me from there. You can buy my book from there. You can also read more about the book and comments about the book, too, that have been posted on the website. So I hope your listeners will take the time to check it out and maybe buy it.
Amazing. We sure will. And we need to invite you to some aesthetics conferences to lecture on this great topic. That's it for now, guys. Thank you so much for joining us today. Check out Karen on her website. And you can find me on our Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, D-R-K-A-Y, doing amazing things with people's faces. And our website is the same.